There is a tradition that rabbis only spoke twice a year. See, everyone's happy. Why did things change? Inflation, right. Thank you. The periods in Jewish tradition and the Jewish calendar where rabbis traditionally spoke were on two important Shabbatot. The first one was Shabbat Shuvah, which is the Shabbat before Yom Kippur. And the second was Shabbat HaGadol, which is this Shabbat, the Shabbat that precedes Pesach. And both of them are, they're both sides of a different coin, where the rabbi on Shabbat Shuvah would stand and he would implore the congregation to do what they're supposed to do in Yom Kippur, which is to be contrite and repentant and search for something better in themselves. And on Shabbat HaGadol, before Pesach, the opposite occurred, and that is that the rabbi's words were highly, highly technical in dealing with a particular element of Pesach that is not found really in any other Jewish holiday. And what I'll say to you is that of all the Jewish holidays, and in particular I'm talking about the ones that are of biblical nature and not certainly those of rabbinic nature, they usually have one outstanding mitzvah that you perform. Maybe two. In the case of Sukkot, we know that there are two particular mitzvot that you observe. But in Pesach, we are told that there are three mitzvot that we observe. And they go in the following order. The first mitzvah that we have is to tell the story of Pesach. And in fact, as it works out to our benefit, that there's an entire book that was developed to help you fulfill that mitzvah. What is that book called? Haggadah. What does the word Haggadah mean? To tell. Lahagid, right? It tells the story. And so the very name of the book that we hold in our hands on the Seder on Pesach is the name of the mitzvah that we have to observe. The second mitzvah that we have is to eat matzah, particularly at the Seder. The rest of the holiday, you're free. You don't have to eat matzah if you don't want to. There's not many other options on the table apart from it, but you're not obligated to eat it. And in fact, at the Seder, the matzah that we eat is called matzah mitzvah. It's a commandment to eat the matzah. Now, the third mitzvah that we have on Pesach is to avoid chametz. Chametz is widely interpreted and understood as being those food products, those things that are derived from a fermentation process. And so obviously foods like breads and pastas and things like that, alcoholic beverages that come from a fermentation process from grains are also prohibited. Scotch, Jerry Rye, I'm sorry. I didn't write the laws, I just repeat them. You understand that, right?
Okay.
And the truth of the matter is that the first two mitzvot, the mitzvah of telling the story and the mitzvah of eating matzah, are both explained in the Haggadah. The reason why we eat matzah, if you look carefully enough, we're not going to talk about it today, if you look carefully enough, there are two contrary answers given in the Haggadah. If you come to my Seder, I'll give you the answer. But today I want to briefly talk about why we're prohibited from eating chametz. Because you could certainly make an argument to say that the commandment at the Seder to eat matzah is not necessarily contrary to eating chametz. In other words, you could have a holiday that would say you must tell the story and you must eat matzah at the Seder. But there's an additional mitzvah that tells us that you're not allowed to eat chametz. And the question for this morning is, why? What I want to do is bring you back I want to bring you back to a primordial moment. The primordial moment that I speak about is the moment where the golden cage of the Garden of Eden is broken. And that is, we know famously that Eve and then Adam eats the fruit of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of tov v'ra, of good and bad. Now, generally, in tradition, what was the fruit? Excuse me. I want to correct myself. What was the food? What was the food that Adam and Eve ate. And when you look widely, Michelangelo famously made it to be an apple. Rabbinic tradition doesn't agree with that, by the way. Apples were not very common in the Middle East thousands of years ago. And so there's different interpretations. Some say it was a fig. Reference because after they eat it, what do they cover themselves with? Fig leaves. Some people say it was a pomegranate. Other people say that it was an etrog that they ate. But there's an opinion in the Talmud, and certainly it's a minority opinion. There's an opinion in the Talmud that says that what they ate was wheat. Wheat. It is a very surprising idea. I'll give you a little hint and we're not going to go down that corridor either. It's just to open the door to think about it, that the transformative thing that made humans leave their hunter-gatherer status to become domesticated and create urban environments was the planting and harvesting of wheat. Wheat transformed humans from small groups of wanderers into civilizations. But we're not going to go down that road. The Kabbalah goes further to say, in thinking about this idea, they say that wheat is both good and bad. Tov v'ra. Good and bad isn't such a good translation because tov v'ra also has the implication of something being righteous or beautiful and something being evil. So what exactly is so evil about chametz, about the wheat that becomes chametz, that particularly on Pesach we're called to avoid? And I want to draw your attention perhaps to a story that I suspect that you know. Cecil B. DeMille made a very big deal of it, and it's drawn from the 7th chapter of the book of Exodus, beginning on verse 14. We are told that smack dab in the middle of the torrent of plagues that come upon Egypt and Pharaoh, that God tells Moses for him to get up early in the morning before sunset and to stand on the bank of the Nile River and wait for Pharaoh to come out of the water. And when Pharaoh comes out of the water, God tells Moses, Pharaoh is going to ask you, why are you here? And then Moses is going to reply to Pharaoh and say that the God of the people of Israel has sent me saying, let my people go. And this was meant to be, of course, another call to Pharaoh to change his path. But many questions arise from this story. First of all, what was Pharaoh doing in the water before sunrise? And the answer to that question is that in ancient Egypt, that the pharaohs were likened or promoted themselves to be gods. And so gods don't go to the washroom. So early in the morning before everyone else woke up, and late at night after everyone went to bed, they would go into the Nile and they would do their ablutions out of the sight of everyone else. And the next question that comes, how would Moses know exactly where to stand and at what time? Because the Nile is an immense river. Where would Moses know to stand, to be at the precise location when Pharaoh was making his way out of the water? And the answer to that question is what Moses told Pharaoh, that only God would know. Because to God, there are no secrets. There is nothing hidden to God. And so when Pharaoh pulls himself out of the water just before the breaking of sunrise and he sees Moses standing there, what should he have said to Moses? He should have said, okay, all right, you know what I know, but the crime, the tragedy of what Pharaoh did, which is the crime and tragedy of what many of us do. In fact, I'm going to be so bold as to say, all of us do it. As Freud famously said, when it comes to self-deception, everyone's an expert. Is that Pharaoh believed his own lies. In English, we refer to people being full of themselves. And what does that mean? It means that people are so filled with the narrative that they speak of themselves, what they imagine themselves to be, is that there's no room for anything else or anyone else in their minds. Now, there are lots of technical terms for people like this, but in popular language, we refer to people as just being conceited, full of themselves. I remember years ago that there was a person who was quoted in the New York Times. I'm not going to say their name, but they were quoted in the New York Times in a review of them. They were referred to as a tour de force of self-promotion. And the story of what we read from Pharaoh is the story writ large in the warning laid at our feet. If you cannot be humble enough that when someone is standing in front of you and making you aware of the warning of the lies that you're living, then you are damned to be crushed. You will fail, and you will bring others down with you. The courage that it takes to walk back from your mistakes is greater and stronger than to continue on the path that you're on. The comparison between bread, chametz, and matzah, according to this teaching, is meant to draw this clearly into our sight. While bread is full and fluffy, the matzah is flat and thin. Once a week, we not only embrace the flat and the thin, but we eschew the fluffy and fullness of ourselves. We remind in the story of Pharaoh how we must live to avoid an outcome like that. Faced with the choice of seeing where life could be or not be, of hearing the constructive criticisms or being blind and deaf to what people say. When I have couples coming into my office complaining about marital problems, invariably, at least one of the partners, as soon as they sit down on the couch in my office, they turn around and say, you know, I'm a good husband. Or someone will say, I'm a good wife. To which I say to them, you shouldn't be the one saying that. If you really want to know, who should you ask? The person you came into the office with. But perhaps it was best said by the Lutheran theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. Niebuhr wrote in the 1950s, he said, if there is no difference between what you think and what God thinks, you're not worshiping God. You're worshiping yourself. On Pesach, we are reminded that we worship God. Shabbat Shalom.